Joining us on the show today is Charles Hugh Smith of the popular Of Two Minds blog. He is an author of numerous books on society and economy, and his latest book is A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All. Charles, I want to say your most recent book, I thought it was going to be mostly about automation, but I was pleasantly surprised to find out that you are tackling some very large subjects, and you get into a number of issues that really excite me, whether or not we're talking about systems and how to understand systems, why our current system, as you say, is flawed and is doomed to failure if we don't change it, and a wide range of other issues, including automation, guaranteed income, you name it. So I'm really excited to get into a lot of these topics in this interview today. But why don't you start off just telling our audience a little bit about some of the background of this book and why you wrote it?
Okay, Chris, I really appreciate your enthusiasm for the topics the book covers. And even if you disagree with my analysis or proposal, I think the point of the book was to get us started thinking about an alternative system to the one we have now. And that's really the core answer to your question is, if we think that the current system is not really sustainable on a number of levels, then we have to ask ourselves, well, what are the alternatives? And so this book is my answer of thinking through, like, well, why is the current system unsustainable, you know, in terms of like resource depletion and the destruction of paid work by automation and the piling up of debt. And, you know, a lot of the issues that your listeners are well aware of, what kind of system would we design if we could start from scratch? And that's what my book proposes.
And I like the fact that you really provide a lot of concrete examples of how we already see this kind of underway with technology. There's a lot of decentralization taking place, whether or not we're talking about the internet and cryptocurrencies. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting subjects that you touch upon and you show as being the bedrock of this new system. But before we get to that, which you talk about in the latter part of your book, maybe we can start off by talking about the fact that we've seen wages soar for a smaller and smaller group of individuals, and yet we've seen this gap between the rich and the poor, wealth inequality, grow more and more as we move forward. And it doesn't appear that this is changing anytime soon. And of course, there's a lot of solutions that are offered to try to fix this problem. But explain to us how you see the current system leading to this problem.
I'm going to turn to economist Michael Spence, who won the Nobel Prize for economics a number of years ago. And he and his colleagues, they sort of avoid the ideological sort of overtones of this rising wealth and income inequality. In other words, the sort of standard narrative is, well, if only we taxed rich people more, then we could solve the problem. And then on the other hand, people say, well, if only we freed up capital and labor to, you know, become more productive, then that would solve the problem. And so this sort of left-right dichotomy actually misses the fundamental narrative, which in Spence's view boils down to this. Conventional labor and conventional capital are both no longer scarce. So their scarcity value in the economy is declining to near zero. And we see this in extremely low interest rates. In other words, ordinary capital doesn't earn a return. You have to do something special with that money or you're not going to get a return. There's just too much of it around. And we all know why, because it's debt money and it's been created and there's no limit on how much debt money you can create. But his other point is standard conventional human labor, where you give somebody a task and explain how to do it and then they do it and you make a profit off that. That's also dropping to zero. So what Spence says is that there's a third kind of capital. This kind of capital is the capital of ideas and new business processes. And because it's not scarce, then this is where all the value goes. This is where the profits flow. So this is why, in his view, companies like Uber are suddenly worth like $50 billion, where like some conglomerate that actually makes chemicals and tires and so on is worth like $1 billion. Is because everything that can be made by factories can be automated. And therefore, once it's been automated, it's been commoditized, which means we don't really care where the tire we buy comes from. It can come from Japan, can come from Bangladesh, it can come from Ohio. It doesn't matter. So what that means is the value of everything that's produced has been commoditized to the point where it doesn't really have a lot of profit in it because it can come from anywhere and it's no longer scarce. I know that's kind of a convoluted way of saying the key issue here is what creates value in the economy. And we talk about profit and so on, but what we're really talking about is creating value. And so everything that's no longer scarce creates very little value. So there's almost no profit there. And what's scarce is what creates the value. And what's scarce in today's economy is good ideas that actually function in the real economy.
Right. And so, like you mentioned, Michael Spence identifies that as the third kind of capital. So low interest rates, you know, capital is extremely cheap nowadays. We have an abundance of credit when you can borrow at near zero interest rates. So that is no longer scarce. You said also the same thing with labor in terms of this new globalized economy that we've moved into where, you know, you can source cheap labor around the globe. So, you know, companies can just go to India or they can go to Indonesia. They can go to all these different areas and find whatever source of labor that they need to provide, whether or not it's IT servicing or manufacturing. So that's that new environment that we're in as well. And now we also have this additional problem, if we want to call it, of automation, which you discussed too. Tell us about the forces of automation and some of the issues that we're having to grapple with. Tell us about how automation fits into this larger scheme.
Well, Chris, you know, we all think of automation as robots in a factory making something without human labor. And of course, we know that's real. And there's a lot of auto and truck manufacturing facilities around the world that are almost all robots. And there's a handful of humans that tend the robots and the cars are produced by a factory with 150 employees. And that factory used to have 3,500 employees, humans doing the assembly. But that kind of automation is just the forefront. And there's still a lot of that to be done in the world. And there's a lot of human labor that we have tended to think is irreplaceable that is going to be replaced by automation. Here's an example that's been in the blogosphere recently is the hamburger flipper is now going to be replaced by a hamburger making machine, right? That does it faster, better, cheaper. Well, even more difficult tasks such as picking vegetables, those are being roboticized. And even things as delicate as harvesting tea leaves, which if you know about tea, it's actually quite a laborious process. You have to pick just a certain part of the tea leaf on the plant, and it's actually quite sensitive. And yet even that's been automated. So we're in the very early stages of human labor being replaced by machines, which are becoming faster, better, cheaper at an accelerating rate. And this was the core story that Bank of America Merrill Lynch came out with, like a 300-page paper. And that was their basic point, was that it's not a linear process anymore of automation replacing human labor. It's basically a geometric expansion. So that's the front line. But behind that front line, there's a whole array of what I call like digital tools that people like you and I use every day, and we don't even think about it. Things like print-on-demand publishing, all the array of software tools that people have to do podcasts. If we think back 20 years, it used to take five people to do one job, to create a broadcast. You had a sound engineer and, you know, a camera guy and a producer and then the talent. And all those people are now been replaced with like one person who can do all that with software. And there's endless examples of that, you know, tax programs that do all the tax work for the vast majority of small businesses. You know, you don't need an accountant anymore. And in the other, even deeper layer is what I call the automation of knowledge, which thanks to like YouTube and the internet, if you have some task that you don't know how to do, well, you can just look up how to do it and then you can do it. You become an instant expert. And in the past, we would have hired somebody that cost several hundred dollars to go do this thing, or we would have bought a whole new appliance or whatever was broken. And that, of course, is what a lot of our economy is based on.
I have a perfect example of that because my neighbor, he's a mechanic, and I was talking to him about how he fixes cars and all that. And he was saying, you know, a lot of times people come in and he just looks it up on YouTube, whatever the part is or whatever the issue is. He's just looking up on YouTube. This is how you fix this thing. And then he watches it and he does it. I mean, that's amazing. He says he doesn't use any manuals anymore. I mean, you know, used to go into mechanic shops and they would have huge, huge stacks of manuals that they'd have to go through, and you'd have a number of mechanics all looking through those. And of course, you know, that knowledge was partly in their head as well. Now it's just YouTube. It's phenomenal.
It is. And so if we extend that, what does it mean for the economy? I mean, we both know what it means is instead of paying somebody, you know, $500 to do a job or even $200, now we can do it ourselves and often in like less than a half hour. So that's a huge amount of labor that's no longer being paid. It's now surplus labor. And we also don't need to buy replacements. You know, in your example, the mechanic can fix it with YouTube and then he can buy a very cheap part, which is probably the production of that part. It's been mechanized and commoditized to the point it's pretty cheap. So we've eliminated a huge amount of economic activity that we're not going to replace.
Now, tell us about this larger economic debate that's taking place, because I would say that automation and its impacts on society and whether or not it's going to be a net benefit or if it's going to be a net negative for society in terms of the amount of jobs being created. This is a pretty popular topic that's been pretty hotly debated by many economists. You cite a number of them, some of which we've had on our show as well. But give us an idea of kind of the debate and the thinking behind automation and where you side on that issue. And where are some of the proposed solutions to automation go wrong?
Let's start by proposing the conventional narrative about automation. And the two camps are, one says technology always creates more jobs than it destroys because there's always higher specialization and human demands for more goods and services is infinite. And so any kind of job loss is temporary. It's some sort of almost natural law of economics that more jobs will be created as technology advances. My sense is that camp is basically engaged in magical thinking, because the core reason why more jobs have been created by the previous industrial revolutions is each industrial revolution created tens of millions of jobs that only needed entry-level skills. In other words, like when the first industrial revolution took people off the farm and put them in a factory making Ford cars, you could learn those jobs in like 5 minutes. In other words, you didn't really need any skills. And in fact, the work was very difficult because it was so monotonous. And then in the second industrial revolution, which includes like telephony and radio, you know, mass communications and mass marketing, I use my own father as an example. He was an appliance salesman at Sears in the 1950s when he had a young family. And just being a salesperson, which you, of course, can go to college and get master's degrees in sales and so on. But, you know, you can also learn to do it in a few days. You know, in other words, sales is not something that you need to get an advanced degree to perform that task. So now the digital revolution, if you will, this current industrial revolution, there's not that many low-end jobs or entry-level jobs created by this. What we see is we see like TaskRabbit kind of things where the surplus labor is bidding for some task and being outbid by somebody else. And so it's like a kind of a Marxist process where the value of labor keeps dropping. And then pretty soon you've got a guy bidding $5 to do some job. And that's not enough to live on. So then you've got a problem there. And then at the high end, the jobs that are created are very high end, like writing software, writing apps, training people to use new technologies, this kind of stuff that is not entry level. And not only that, but we're not creating tens of millions of those jobs. It's that a lot of those jobs are actually creating software that replaces their own labor. So my contention is this digital revolution is of a different type and a different quality than the previous industrial revolutions. And those people who think that technology always creates more jobs simply haven't looked at the difference between these revolutions.
Okay. So you believe that this third industrial revolution that we're seeing, which is largely digital, that it's not creating more jobs than it destroys, which is the conventional narrative. So there is a larger recognition by many that that is a potential outcome. You believe that that is in fact true. But for those who say, okay, perhaps this is where we're moving, that there is something fundamentally different this time, that this time is different in terms of how automation is affecting society. There's this idea that perhaps we can solve this problem of mass unemployment from automation by providing a guaranteed income for all. Explain to us why that won't work.
The answer in my mind is, let's start with how we create profit, because the general idea of that guaranteed income for all is we're going to tax the owners of robots who are going to be making so much money that they will make enough money to fund a guaranteed income for everyone. And what I started with was, well, let's put some numbers together. It's not brain surgery here. You know, the current federal government spends like $2.6 trillion and local and state governments spend another trillion and so on. So we know that the government already spends over $4 trillion providing much of these entitlements that we already offer. So what we're talking about is we want the government to spend an additional number of trillions of dollars to fund basically super welfare for even more people. So we know that that's going to cost even more money than the current system. And so then we ask, well, how many companies would we need to be extremely profitable to pay for this? And I use examples like Facebook, Twitter, and Google, which are extremely high profit margin companies, right? And if we do the math, we discover that Facebook makes, you know, $3.5 or $4 billion and Google makes 14 billion or so, 14 or 15 billion. Well, we would need something like 400 Facebooks just to fund the government we have. We would need like 250 Googles, each making 15 billion a year forever. And the thing is there's only one Google. It already dominates its entire space, you know, and there's only one Facebook and there's only one Alibaba. And then Twitter, as we all know, is actually losing money. So the idea that our economy can fund this out of profits from the owners of robots is actually like mathematically nonsense. There's just not enough profit there to tax. And then the other thing that the people who say, let's tax the robots and it'll fund everything, you know, we can fund $6 trillion in entitlements. They don't see the dynamic at work in automation, which is it actually not just crushes paid labor, it crushes profits, because with capital essentially worthless and easily available, then what's to stop somebody from buying a robot to compete with you and your robot? Well, nothing. And then the cost of that robot is dropping rapidly. And so robots just a few years ago were like $40,000, are now like $22,000. You know, that's like the Baxter programmable type robot. And then a lot of software is free. And in fact, AutoCAD, which is the company that makes a line of design software products, CAD, CAM, you know, they just have issued like a free version that used to cost thousands of dollars per copy. They've issued it for like a nominal fee. And this is the future. This is the way it works. Is if you want to survive as an enterprise, you're going to have to provide free tools so people can use your product. And then your profit is no longer from that initial sale. It's like a derivative of people using your product. And so profits actually are destroyed by automation. And if people say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. Well, really, look at IBM. I mean, its profits and sales are plummeting. And that's partly because all the tools that you used to pay thousands of dollars for are now available for either nothing or for like a few dollars. And so automation is relentless in its destruction of profits. So people who say, oh, well, we can just tax the owners of robots. No, because not only are the owners of robots going to be competing against everyone else who can buy a robot like with free money, they can move their robots out of your high tax area. And there's absolutely no incentive for them to stay in a high tax area. And so right now we're in the end of this bubble phase of this financial bubble, and places like California, where I live, that it's extremely high tax. They're under the illusion that it's going to be forever. They can always just tax the next Google. And the idea that Google's profits could actually be threatened by competition doesn't occur to them.
Right. And I love the example that you use where if you were just to confiscate all the profits of Google, Facebook, and Twitter and to fund this guaranteed minimum income for all, like you pointed out, you'd have to have hundreds and hundreds of Googles and Facebooks and Twitters. And with all that competition between these essentially monopolies at this point, or these companies that have very little competition in their own space currently, well, that's going to lower their profits once you have all these different. So it's just doesn't logically make sense. Now, I want to move to another part of this, which I think is really important that you point out. And that's this sort of utopian view and the effects of, instead of a lot of us working and the robots are doing everything for us, you know, we're free to just become artists, musicians, or whatnot. Now, I want to quote actually a portion of your book because it goes to show just how good of a writer you are. And I love this part. So let me quote this. The petite bourgeois fantasy of every individual flowering as an artist, musician, and creator, once freed of work, is an abstraction, one born of the expansion of academic enclaves and private wealth-funded dilettantes fluttering from one salon to the next. Unpack that for us. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, Chris, and I don't want to be too harsh on people that were fortunate enough to inherit wealth, but if we look at people who don't have to work, a lot of them, in fact, in my view, from those I know, the vast majority are actually very unhappy. And virtually every trust funder I've known or have known of, it has a therapist, because it turns out that once you no longer have to work, you've lost the purpose and meaning of your life, because work is actually core to being human. So the idea that once we don't have to work, we're actually going to be happy doesn't hold up once we examine it. And of course, if we look at where welfare has taken over communities, we find that there's great dysfunction and great unhappiness and despair. And I think there's absolutely no mystery in this, that once you take away the opportunity to have a positive social role, which is like what work provides. In other words, you're doing something useful. You're being recognized. You're part of a community or a group pursuing a goal. And this could be a corporation. It could be a community group. It could be a faith-based organization. There's lots of different groups that fulfill these, but it all comes down to work. And so if you don't have any work, you have no purpose and no source of meaning and pride. And so humans really fall apart when they're deprived of their livelihoods and meaningful work. So there's been this article that was in the Atlantic magazine that's made a lot of impressions on the internet recently about how middle-aged white people are dying at earlier ages. Instead of their lives being longer, they're actually being shorter. And the authors of the piece identify the cause as despair. And to me, it's very obvious. What's the source of despair? Will you take away people's opportunities to have a positive social role and meaningful work? As humans, we fall into despair.
Yeah, that's right. And to pick up another quote from your book, and this is actually, you excerpted part of your book recently, and we published this on our site. We're going to link out to this as well if you want to see the excerpt and read it. But you say, humans draw meaning from producing, not consuming, and from belonging to a group that provides a larger goal than self-indulgence, which is the ultimate objective of spiritually impoverished consumerism. So that goes back to what you just said, as work providing a positive social role for people. Now, I want to move on to another point that you make that I think is really important. It's a recurring theme that you present in your book, which I think is very helpful for understanding the current system that we see today versus the system that you propose. And that is the jelly bean economy. Would you mind explaining what you mean by that?
Well, in the book, I describe a very simple economy, which is made up of a company that makes jelly beans and sells them to the public. And then there's a pharmaceutical industry that arose to counter all the negative effects of only eating jelly beans.
Right.
And then there's a small group of people that didn't buy into the jelly bean economy, and they grow their own vegetables and they don't buy any jelly beans. And the government, of course, views these people as a tremendous threat, because they're not buying into the jelly bean economy. They're not creating sales. They're not creating profits that the government needs to tax to generate its own revenues. The point of the jelly bean economy was that you can actually have a deeply pernicious and self-destructive system that appears to work fine on the surface.
Yeah, and it seems like when it comes to the different fixes or solutions proposed by different political leaders, whether on the left or the right, it all boils down to switching out the colors of the jelly beans.
That's right. We're not really changing any of the parameters or the dynamics of the system. We're simply changing the color of the jelly beans and wondering why we're getting sick and fat from only eating jelly beans, because it doesn't really matter what flavor of jelly beans you're eating. You know, the output, the result is going to be the same.
Okay, so tell us a bit about this new system that you propose, because it's more of a decentralized model. It's based on existing technologies, as you point out, and there's a lot of different examples that we see today of companies thriving based on this more networked sort of model. Give us a taste of what you're proposing, where you think we're headed.
Well, Chris, let's take the starting point as what kind of economic system would we devise if we were starting from scratch? In other words, if we just started with a clean slate, what would we do with the existing technologies that have arisen really in the past like decade or two? So my answer is, well, let's take money. And we all think that money has to be either gold or silver, or it's created by a government or a central bank. But Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies has shown us that you can actually create money in a decentralized fashion. You don't need a central bank to create money. And so that's something that gives us a whole new way of creating and distributing money. And then we take systems like Yelp, which is an example of a system in which your reputation as an enterprise is strengthened or diminished by the users. And so it's a system that doesn't require an editor, so to speak, or a higher authority. You know, it's basically the users are creating the value within the system. And if we take like Craigslist, we discover that you can create a global marketplace that only needs about 35 or 40 people to operate. In other words, it's an amazing amount of leverage. And if we look at these systems like Craigslist and Yelp and the free software that's out there, even YouTube, the leverage is enormous. And so the number of people needed to operate these systems is extremely small. And yet the number of users that have access to this is like in the hundreds of millions. And so that's kind of my thinking is, what if we combine these systems? We can see the outlines of an economy that is entirely decentralized and creates and uses its own money, and that is more of a social economy as opposed to a strictly financial one. And by that, I mean, what are we valuing within this economic structure? And I call it, and I think other people do too, a social economy, which means we value meaningful work and full employment more than profit. And profit's still important and it's a good thing, but it's not the only thing.
Right. And you refer to this as the community labor integrated money economy, or CLIM.
And of course, that's a clever little writerly thing that we're climbing out of the morass of unsustainability and doom, and we're climbing into a better, more sustainable system. But the idea here is to integrate, you know, the creation of money, labor, and community in a way that we currently just kind of assume happens by magic. In other words, we just kind of put the stuff under the pillow, and then, you know, we wake up the next day and, hey, magically money has created work and it's created community and all this. And I don't think it does. In other words, if we create money the way we do now with central banks and we give it to people at the top of the wealth pyramid, then they're simply using that money to buy existing income streams, and they're outbidding those of us who have savings, you know. And so that's why we have wealth inequality, is the people at the top have unlimited access to capital and they can outbid the rest of us for the best assets. And so we're not going to change that system unless we change the way we create and distribute money. And if I borrow $100 million for almost nothing and buy an apartment building and then double the rents, which is like what's happening in today's economy, I haven't created any new jobs. I've simply created a rentier skim where I'm now extracting more of the wealth of my tenants. I'm not having created any jobs. And so the idea that creating money, borrowing it into existence as we do now, that it's going to magically create work, is completely fallacious. It has no substance at all.
Yeah, that's right. And you give the example of the Fed using quantitative easing to lower the cost of capital. And so then companies will borrow and then use that to buy back their shares. And essentially, that doesn't create any jobs at all. It just changes the metric of their earnings. So it appears as if they have greater earnings. And then another example, of course, is by using that low cost of capital to implement greater use of automation, which, again, does not create more jobs as well. So there's a number of examples that you give in which the current system, as it's designed, is not leading to a beneficial condition for workers. Now, I think there's another point that you make that's really important, and that is that the way different economies function, whether or not they're socialistic, democratic, Marxist, you know, capitalistic, they're not ideological in nature. That is that it wasn't necessarily ideologies that led to them per se, but it was really a consequence of the functioning of the people in that area. A lot of times ideology may come afterward as a way of perhaps trying to add legitimacy to it. But when it comes to the current system and perhaps where we're headed and this new model that you propose and perhaps identify that we're seeing at work, this isn't a matter of ideology. It's really a matter of efficiencies and what is going to work better. And that's really being driven from the bottom up and not from the top down.
That's an excellent point, Chris. And you're right about the systems and the legitimacy or delegitimization of systems by the output. In other words, we can say, oh, well, that system's left or right or centrist or whatever, but the system produces its outputs regardless of our beliefs. And so that's a key part of systems thinking, is we sort of need to strip away our sort of opinions and our ideological biases about what works and actually look at the output. And this is, of course, extraordinarily difficult for us humans because we base our identities on our political and spiritual beliefs. And so it's very difficult for us to make decisions based on data, but this is really part of what that decentralization process that you mentioned. That's the sort of fuel for decentralization, is it works better. It creates better, faster, better, cheaper outputs than the current system. And just to give a quick example, and I'm sure you could list many more, a lot of people feel that something like rent control is a very good idea. In other words, it's justice, you know, and there's a social justice there in keeping rents low and so on. And we all understand that's a good idea. We want low rents for people that aren't making a lot of money and so on. But it turns out, if we look at the data, that it actually destroys the very thing that people are seeking, which is abundant housing and a variety of price ranges. And so that idea simply doesn't work. No matter how much we like the idea or we value the goal of social justice and all that stuff, we have to design systems that actually produce the outputs we want. And that's a different thing than believing in an ideology.
Well, I couldn't agree more. We've been speaking with Charles Hugh Smith. The title of his book is A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All. I do want to highly recommend that all of our listeners pick it up. You can do so at Amazon. We'll have the link to where this interview is located. If you would like to get it on your Kindle or get a digital copy, you can do that. Charles, I want to thank you. And you've just written an excellent book. You've tackled so many different subjects and you've hit on many topics that are near and dear to my heart, topics that I love to explore, and there's no way we could cover it all in one interview. So with that said, definitely go out and get this book, read it. You're going to enjoy it.
Thank you, Chris. It's been my pleasure.
I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at financialsense.com.